And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. We have a very special guest today, Mr. David Keene. He's the president of the National Rifle Association. Mr. Keene has been active in politics since 1968. He's worked for President Richard Nixon, President Ronald Reagan, and President George Herbert Walker Bush. He is here today just in time for the elections to help us differentiate between our two presidential candidates when it comes to guns rights. Mr. Keene, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Oh, absolutely. And again, the timing could not be better. You know, I've heard Barack Obama, while pandering to a crowd of independents, say that he's always believed that the Second Amendment was an individual right. I'm guessing his voting record tells a different story?
Yes, it sure does. Like a lot of anti-gun liberals, President Obama has tried to fuzz his position on gun rights as an election approaches. But this is a guy who, long before he ever ran for public office, was an anti-Second Amendment activist. He was on the board of the Joyce Foundation in Chicago years ago, which spent millions of dollars trying to convince the legal community that there was and is no individual right to keep and bear arms, the view that was rejected by the Supreme Court in the Heller decision, which ratified the amendment as written by the founders. As a legislator in Illinois and in the Senate, he voted against every anti-gun measure he could find. He said in the past that he doesn't think any citizen individually and privately has the right to own a firearm. He has suggested that concealed carry laws in the state should be abolished. He's urged that it be made illegal for sidearms to be owned, purchased, traded, or manufactured in the United States. And he's basically the most anti-Second Amendment, anti-gun rights president we've ever had.
One of the things that scares me about Obama is I think he's been saving this second term for all the crazy stuff that would have turned off, that would turn off independents. For example, you know, we all heard him whisper to the Russians that, you know, I'll have more flexibility after the election. And when it comes to banning guns, we've heard him say, well, we're doing some things under the radar. And translation, if he openly did any of this stuff before the election, he wouldn't get elected. So he's going to save the stuff America wouldn't like for his second term. If he gets a second term, are Americans about to have their gun ownership rights taken away?
They're certainly going to face the greatest challenge to their gun ownership rights that they've ever faced. He has found, as have previous politicians who wanted to take our gun rights away from us, that it's very dangerous to confront the Second Amendment community directly because there are so many people who believe in the Second Amendment. There's a majority of Second Amendment believers in both houses of Congress from both parties. So going to Congress and, for example, asking that they reinstitute the Clinton gun ban, which is what he suggested in the town hall debate, is not going to happen, not unless there's a significant change in the makeup of both houses. But what he can do is this, and this is even more dangerous. The Heller decision, which, as I said, was the Supreme Court decision that says that individual Americans have the right to keep and bear arms, was a 5-4 decision. If Barack Obama is reelected, just because of the age of the makeup of the Supreme Court, it is likely that he's going to be able to appoint 1, 2, or maybe even 3 Supreme Court justices. He will be able to create an Obama Supreme Court. And such a court could reverse the Heller decision or, in the alternative, could allow restrictions to such an extent that it would be meaningless in terms of practical everyday life. That's the biggest threat that one faces directly during a second Obama administration. But there are two other things that he can and probably will do. First of all, he'll continue the regulatory harassment of gun dealers around the country. The number of gun dealers has dropped since he became president, and that could continue to happen. He, in the past, has proposed that anybody under 18 be not allowed on federal lands if they with a firearm, which would outlaw hunting in much of the West, would make it impossible for people to take their sons and daughters hunting, because out there, if you don't have public land on which to hunt, you don't have very much, because most of it is public land. He has, in the past, when he first came in, suggested that There'd be significant taxes on ammunition that would, again, drive sort of the marginal user of firearms out. But then the other thing he could do, in addition to the regulatory and court approach, is he can sign a treaty with the United Nations that would go around everything and allow him to get at our Second Amendment rights. In a sense, we were lucky this year because a treaty was in the final stages of negotiation late this summer at the United Nations, and the administration had earlier signaled a willingness to work with and hopefully sign such a treaty. But it is on a separate time track from the elections. And the only thing I can figure that happened was one day somebody at the White House woke up and looked at what was going on and said, oh, my goodness, if the president signs this treaty, it's going to be on the Senate floor in September, and that's not good. So we essentially dodged a bullet, but he could sign it as a lame duck president. It's going to come up again, and there are going to be a number of international efforts directed at the United States. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
People's Republic of China, before the United Nations Human Rights Commission, has filed a complaint against the United States, alleging that the private ownership of firearms is definitionally a human rights violation and that, therefore, steps should be taken to make certain that the United States stops this sort of thing. So a president who's hostile to the Second Amendment has a lot of options, options that are particularly dangerous because of the Supreme Court makeup and the likelihood that the next 4 years are going to allow the next president to put a real lasting stamp on that court.
There's nothing like being lectured on human rights violations by China.
That's right. You know, I was a delegate to the last small arms conference at the United Nations. I was appointed by George W. Bush. It's on a 5-year cycle, and you don't have to spend much time up there to realize why it is that these folks don't want their citizens to have guns, because if many of them did, they wouldn't be back. You know, the United States is a unique country. And let me tell you just a little story about that that sort of brought it home to me some years ago.
Okay.
Some years back in Moscow, they held a banquet on the occasion of General Kalashnikov's 85th birthday. General Kalashnikov, of course, was the man who invented the AK-47 back during World War II and is one of the few Russian heroes that are around. The toast at the banquet was given by Mr. Putin. And when Putin finished, the old general stood up, raised his glass in front of Mr. Putin and said, Mr. President, my dream is of a country like the United States, governed by men and women not afraid of an armed populace. Think about that. Most people in the world can only dream of living in such a country, the kind of country we've lived in since its founding. And that sort of brings home to you just what all of this means. They had in Russia recently on their television program a debate on whether Russians should be allowed the right to privately own firearms. And they did it like Dancing with the Stars, you know, so everybody called in. And the support for the right to privately own firearms was 76% of those who called in. But the closing argument in the debate was of interest because the fellow said, you know, let's think about it. In the United States of America, private citizens have the right to own firearms. In all of the countries that were once under the yoke of the old Soviet government, when they became free, one of the first things they did was pass legislation to allow their citizens to own privately owned firearms. And then he said, so what's wrong with us Russians? The point is that in most of the world, this isn't possible. You know, 85% of all the privately owned firearms in the world are owned here in the United States. And that makes us a target for all of these people who don't want their citizens to be free.
I understand. And I'm looking at a quote by Thomas Jefferson as you shared that with my audience. And he said the strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government. And I think that's a big part of what's going on right now with the gun purchases. I'll share a story with you now. The day after President Obama was elected, a local gun shop owner named Mike Stulcy was heading into his store early to open it up. I mean, obviously, as the owner, he would always get there a little early. And as he pulled up to the shopping center where his gun store was located, he saw a long line that went around the shopping center. And he's right next to a Starbucks. And he said, oh, my goodness, what kind of a promotion does Starbucks have going on today? But as he opened his door, and he wasn't even open yet, people started crowding and pushing in behind him to get in his store. Obviously, the American people are shrewd enough to realize that this president poses a risk to have their gun rights taken away, their gun ownership rights taken away.
Well, that was exactly right, and that was very clear during the run-up to the 2008 election. Remember, during the Pennsylvania primary, Barack Obama was caught on tape saying, there were all these folks who were afraid of modern times who sit in churches clinging to their Bibles and their guns because they're afraid of the world in which we live. He characterized gun owners as a sort of a small, nutty minority of citizens. Nothing could be further from the truth, of course. In a recent survey, respondents were asked by a national pollster whether they live in a gun-owning household. And in this country, households headed by people over 30, men or women, a majority are gun-owning households. We asked voters in Wisconsin during the recall election in an exit poll, asked everybody, a sample of everybody who voted, do you agree with the goals and principles of the National Rifle Association? And 45% of them had a very simple answer. That answer was yes. So gun owners are a huge constituency in this country. Last year, for the first time in decades, the number of people who took to the field to go hunting increased. Guns are much more popular than they were. You know, in the last 5 years, the membership of the NRA, which numbers about 4 million, the biggest increase has come from women. I talked to the organizers of some of the East Coast's biggest gun shows not too long ago, and they keep track of this because it's how they make a living. And they told me that 5 years ago, 8% of the people who attended their gun shows were women. Last year, it was 38%. High schools that abandon their shooting teams back in the 60s or 70s are reinstituting them. The Boy Scouts are more active in gun training and safety training than they have been in the past. The NRA just worked with the Boy Scouts at their new Jamboree location in West Virginia to build a facility where scouts can load their own ammunition and fire it on the range and all. So the Second Amendment is something that's valued by millions upon millions of Americans. And when somebody characterizes those millions of Americans as a tiny minority who he dislikes, one can't be surprised that they think that their rights are being threatened. They go out to buy firearms before they'll be restricted. And more importantly, regardless of their politics, and gun owners are Republicans and Democrats, they're union members and farmers and small business owners and housewives, regardless of their politics, they have demonstrated time and again that when they perceive and understand that their Second Amendment rights are under threat, they go to the ballot box and they do what they need to do to get rid of the politicians who would strip them of those rights. When Barack Obama, after the 2008 episode, tried to soft pedal his position on guns until the town hall debate, where he was asked a question which I don't think he expected on firearms, and it was as if he had opened the closet door, stuck his head out, and said, oh yeah, by the way, the NRA's been right all these years, I don't like firearms, and if I ever get a chance, I'm going to do something about it. That was a wake-up call to people who might have been lulled during the last 4 years into thinking that maybe he doesn't pose the threat that we know that he does pose. The reason he hasn't done anything of real import during those 4 years, except harass gun dealers and except do what he can under the radar, as he put it to Sarah Brady, of handgun control. The reason he hasn't done anything else is because he hasn't been able to. He hasn't been able to prevail in the courts. He hasn't been able to prevail in the Congress on these issues. And so, like with the Russians, he said, let me get past this election when I'll be more flexible and when I can do the things that I need to do. Well, we don't want him to get past this election. We're out there today talking to as many gun owners, as many hunters, as many collectors, as many competitive shooters, as many people who keep firearms in their home for self-protection to say, if you want to be able to exercise your constitutional rights in the future, you'd better get out there on November 6th and vote for a presidential candidate that won't lead an assault on the Second Amendment.
For a guy who's obviously been against guns his entire political career, I want to play a quote from Barack Obama, and let me have you tell the audience what you make of this.
We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded.
What do you make of that? Here's a guy that sounds like he wants his own private army.
He sure does. Unfortunately, he didn't get one. But this is a guy, after all, that has said in the past that he wishes he could rule the way they do in China, so he wouldn't have to worry about separation of powers and dealing with a Congress that's often hostile to him. You know, fellas like that who have little regard for the Constitution dream of the kind of power that he seems to be expressing a desire to have there, but they're not going to get it, not in our system, not as long as citizens are awake and their representatives in Congress and the Senate listen to them.
You mentioned the harassment of gun shop owners. A lot of people would argue that the Fast and Furious program was never about really stopping guns going to Mexico, never really about arresting those who work for Mexican drug lords, but in fact was set up from the very beginning to harass gun shop owners. And in fact, the same gun shop owners that were encouraged to make these sales to people from Mexico who might be using them for the wrong purpose so that those people could be caught are the ones who are actually being harassed.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, I'm sure that you and a lot of your listeners have read the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Mm-hmm.
And Holmes was famous in these stories for saying, when you've eliminated all the improbable motives and the impossible motives, and there's only one explanation left, no matter how far-fetched it might seem, it has to be the truth. And in this instance, they had no plan to prosecute people. They couldn't follow the guns. They had no plan to follow the guns. They had no plan to trace them. What they did was they forced gun dealers on our southern border. They forced them by basically saying to them, we license you. If you want to continue in business, you better cooperate. You better do what we want. All of them had objected, and all of them cooperated, because they do, in fact, depend on government licensing to stay in business. They sold thousands of guns to straw purchasers, which were then turned over to Mexican drug cartels. The BATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which ran this operation for the Obama administration, didn't even tell their own agents in Mexico they were doing it. They didn't inform the Mexican government. They didn't have any way to trace the weapons. And what they said was, well, we'll see, because they'll show up at crime scenes. They have. 200 or so Mexicans have been killed. A U.S. border agent has been killed. Then the Washington Post ran a series on criminal gun dealers on our southern border. The gun dealers they ran the series on were the gun dealers that were selling these guns that were going to the Mexican drug cartel, and it turned out that their names were given to the Washington Post by leaks from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So not only did they force these people to do something illegal, they then tried to demonize them and destroy their careers and their personal lives by leaking it to the press. And the Post was taken in by that. You know, when you really look at what happened, and think about what they did, and then think about what would have happened if three agents had not been so offended after the killing of the Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, if they hadn't been so offended that they went first to CBS and then to Senator Grassley and Congressman Issa. If that hadn't happened today, we could expect to be seeing the President of the United States and his Attorney General standing in front of a microphone saying that we need more gun control laws because U.S. dealers are selling and supplying arms to Mexican criminal cartels. It turned out that legitimate U.S. dealers were not doing that. It was the United States government that was doing it. And it was only uncovered because of those agents. And then, when it's all over, after engaging in a classic cover-up, which saw former administration officials taking the Fifth Amendment before Congress, the President of the United States goes on Univision, is asked a question about Fast and Furious, and his response, as it is whenever something bad happens on his watch, he says, oh, well, you know, that was a Bush administration program, and as soon as we learned about it, we stopped it. ABC News came back and said, basically, no, Mr. President, it was not a Bush administration program. Fast and Furious began in October of 2009, George W. Bush was in Crawford, Texas, fixing a fence. You were in the White House, and you didn't end that program when you learned about it. You only ended it when it became so embarrassing and so dangerous to you and your administration that you couldn't continue with it. That was a program that was, regardless of whose sick mind initially came up with it, whether it was in the White House or in Arizona or in the Justice Department, that everybody involved, all the way up to the top, said this is a great way to build a case for gun control, and that's what they tried to use it for.
Well, I think whenever Hillary Clinton made her remark about all the guns going south from America into Mexico and America's thirst for illegal drugs, you know, it was part of the Blame America First game that liberals like to play, and it's not surprising that something like this would happen. I'd like to clarify this thing about Bush started fast and furious, because I'm sick of hearing that. And if I'm not mistaken, the Bush program was called Wide Receiver. There were some similarities, but in the Bush program, the guns never actually made it past the border.
Well, there were several at the very, if you just skim the surface, there was a similarity.
Okay.
What the Bush program did was they planted tracking devices inside firearms. They then allowed those firearms to go, and they actually, you know, followed them with planes, and they tried to keep track of them at every step so that they had both a chain of evidence and an ability to pick up whoever the ultimate receiver of those firearms were. They knew about it, and so did the Mexican authorities who were cooperating with them. Now, what happened was two things. One, those tracking devices failed, and some of the people buying the firearms figured out the tracking devices were in them and destroyed them. So as soon as that was learned, the program was immediately ended, and the guns were gotten back. I'm told that maybe a dozen guns were lost as a result of that. But the real question was, what was the motive? In that case, there was clearly a plan to try and get bad guys as a result of what they were doing. In the Obama case, there wasn't. But more importantly, and a president can always say, I didn't know what was going on, or my attorney general didn't know what was going on lower down in the government. The real responsibility of the higher-ups in a government is when they learn about a program that's badly run, that's badly conceived, or isn't working, or is working at cross purposes to what it was set up to do, what do they do about it? When the Bush administration learned that a few guns were about to disappear because the tracking devices were broken, they stopped the whole program immediately and went out and retrieved the guns. When the Obama administration learned that thousands of guns were just disappearing, we're talking now at the highest levels, they said, you know, we can use this to argue for gun control, and they doubled down.
Absolutely amazing. And a lot of people are very concerned about Hillary Clinton and her efforts with the UN to ban small arms. Now, define that. What are they defining as small arms?
Well, it's interesting because they're talking about what they call a small arms trade treaty. When the small arms conference began years ago, they were talking about, you know, artillery pieces, small artillery pieces, rocket launchers, you know, all those kinds of things. And then the UN decided to extend it to sporting arms and sidearms. The United States at that time objected, and they said, no, we're keeping that in because there are a lot of sporting arms that could be misused. 85% of all such guns are in the United States. So this was directed right at us and right at the individual who purchases arms for sporting purposes or for self-defense purposes. So it includes everything. And it's on a five-year track. In other words, they meet every 5 years, and then they come up with a treaty, or are supposed to. I was a delegate to the last one, the one before this, appointed by George W. Bush, and we ran the clock out on them then, because although we don't have a lot of friends in the United Nations in numerical terms, when the United States stands up and says, we will not accept this, people sort of back off. And back then, John Bolton, first at the State Department and then as ambassador to the United Nations, made very clear at George Bush's direction that our policy was simple. We would not participate in, accept, or in any way cooperate with any effort that would impinge upon the Second Amendment constitutional rights of American citizens. And we ran out the clock. When Barack Obama came in, his new Secretary of State went to the UN and said, that red line is gone. We want to work with you. We want to cooperate with you. We want to see what can be accomplished. And so this year, they were approaching the point where they would have a small arms treaty that would, in fact, affect the American people. And because of the fact that if it was signed, it was going to be on the Senate floor in September, I think that the administration backed off. The president could still sign it. They could still come up with something afterwards. But that's a real and continuing danger, what you've got at the United Nations. And the reason there's so much interest on the part of the anti-gun community in the UN is, let's face it, they failed here. They failed in Congress. They failed in the courts. They failed in the state legislatures and in most cities. And as a result, they haven't been able to accomplish any of their goals. So what's happened is that both the politicians and the so-called NGOs, the private groups like Handgun Control that are opposed to the private ownership of firearms, have gone to the international community and said, maybe we can use the UN and maybe we can get a friendly president who will use his power to sign a treaty to accomplish what we can't get Congress to accomplish directly. Now, this time, because, as I said earlier, there is a pro-Second Amendment majority in Congress, and it consists of members of both parties, 58 members of the Senate sent a letter to the president and to the Secretary General of the UN and said, don't even try it. You send us a treaty, we're going to tear it up and throw it in the trash. But think about this. During the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton signed the Kyoto Treaty, the global warming treaty.
I was just thinking that.
And he didn't send it up to be ratified because he knew the votes weren't there. But what he did do was then say, okay, I've signed this treaty. It requires us to do A, B, C, and D. And I am going to try through executive orders and the regulatory regime to accomplish as much of it as I can without sending the treaty itself to the Senate for ratification. That's what would happen. That's what would happen if Obama signed such a treaty. It would be rejected by the Senate, but that would not end the threat as a result of its signing.
I'm amazed by how many people have discussed the global warming nonsense along with the effort to ban Americans from owning guns as being all part of the same movement.
Well, it's interesting because if you think about it, the sort of reason that I just stated as to why the anti-gun people have gone to the UN, because they failed here. The same thing is being done by a lot of other left-wing interests who have failed to accomplish their goals through the legislative and judicial process in the United States. They've decided, like the anti-gun crowd, to sort of circle over, leapfrog the Congress, leapfrog the U.S. courts, and try to find a friendly president who will work with them to accomplish in the international arena what they can't accomplish here at home. And so it's not just the Second Amendment. It's the United Nations and the international forums that it represents have to be watched very closely by Americans interested in preserving their freedoms.
Do you have time for one more question, sir?
I sure do.
Fantastic. I was listening to NRA radio one evening, and the on-air person was talking about the numerous bogus studies by the left that try to demonstrate that concealed carry licensees commit a higher rate of crimes than the general population. And he was pointing out that these studies are flawed, you know, in terms of their methodology. Would you address that for my audience?
Sure. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Michael Bloomberg, who is every gun owner's worst nightmare, is running a group, is funding a group to strip us of our Second Amendment rights, and he's particularly offended by the very concept of concealed carry. He came out with a study which showed that X number of concealed carry owners had been involved in crimes or one sort or another, some involving guns, some not involving guns. And that sounded like a horrendous thing until an enterprising reporter took a similar sample of people that didn't have concealed carry permits and found out that a higher percentage of them were involved in such crimes.
Right.
So, you know, they always say that numbers can lie and liars know how to use numbers. Well, Michael Bloomberg knows exactly how to use those numbers. The fact is, I was talked to not too many years ago by a television producer who said, you know, the empirical evidence that you're right, that the NRA is right and the gun owners are right, is right there for everyone to see. Because in the last few decades, as state after state has passed concealed carry laws, politicians have stood up and said, pass this law and there are going to be gunfights in bars. There are going to be shootings at traffic intersections. When everybody gets mad at each other, they're just going to blow each other away. And yet, in every single jurisdiction that's passed a concealed carry law, violent crime and felons using guns on innocent civilians has dropped, not increased. It's dropped. And that's the empirical evidence. But the Michael Bloombergs of the world don't accept that evidence because their drive against firearms is not just about crime. It's not just about firearms. It's about the symbolism of the Second Amendment and what it represents. Remember, we had a Supreme Court justice recently in Europe quoted as saying, if you're going to write a constitution, don't pattern it on ours, because our constitution includes a lot of what she called archaic rights that don't really fit in the modern world. These are folks that don't like the arrangement that the founders came up with. They don't really like the idea of individual responsibility and an individual standing up for himself or herself. They think everything should be handled by the state, by the community. And the Second Amendment is, if anything, the strongest signal in the Constitution that this was written for free citizens who took responsibility for their own lives, for their own protection, and for protecting the kind of free country that they wanted and which they formed back then. And that's what it's all about. It's about values. You know, prior to the late 1960s and the early 70s, the NRA wasn't involved in politics. We didn't endorse candidates. We didn't have a lobbying operation. We didn't need it because until the cultural wars of the 70s broke out, there was no disagreement politically in this country on Second Amendment rights. Life members of the NRA included everybody from Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Roosevelt to Hubert Humphrey and John Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, many of whom hunted, many of whom shot competitively, but all of whom recognized the Second Amendment as a valuable part of our heritage and our Constitution. That broke down with the cultural wars and the clash of values that took place in the 70s and 80s.
One of the other things I heard about the studies, Mr. Keene, is that when these liberals do studies trying to show that those who have a concealed carry license commit more crimes, they'll go down the police rolls and say, well, a man named John Smith committed a burglary. Ah, here's a John Smith that owns that has a concealed carry license. Must be the same guy. They don't do anything to check that out. But
they're only interested in finding a result that that supports their arguments. They're not interested in the truth. They're not interested in the empirical evidence, or they'd have already changed their mind.
I have a concealed carry license, and I was honored when I took my concealed carry class to have a gentleman in the class who was renewing his license. He was the ranking manager on duty at the Luby's cafeteria in Killeen, Texas, the day the shooter came in, which, as you know, that resulted
right.
in Texas passing the concealed carry laws. And he was telling us stories of the bloodshed that day and how later that night, something like 7 or 8 o'clock at night, they found one of the dishwashing boys hidden in the dishwasher. When he heard the shooting, he was so scared that he opened the dishwasher and he jumped in that dishwasher with the boiling water.
Mm-hmm.
That's how bad it was. And when I hear people say that someone like myself, who actually goes to the trouble to go out and take the written test, take the shooting test, have myself fingerprinted, someone who's doing it the right legal way so that they can carry a weapon is more likely to commit a crime, it's ridiculous. And, you know, we hear this all the time. When we were trying to pass concealed carry here in Texas, we heard the same things in the paper. You know, police officers were saying, well, yeah, and, you know, every time there's a wreck, there's going to be a shooting, or we're going to be in the middle of a shootout with someone, and the concealed carry guy isn't going to know who the good guy is and who the bad guy is, and he's going to shoot us. And, you know, we heard all these potential horror stories, and none of them have come to pass. And I can tell you on a personal level, I was approached in a parking lot, and a gentleman literally tried to rip my iPhone off my belt. And I was carrying a concealed weapon. I did not immediately pull out my gun and started shooting. I looked at the guy. You know, he was about 5 foot nothing. He looked like he was strung out on drugs, nothing but skin and bones. And I simply pushed him away from me, and I said, get back. You're not getting the phone. And he just sort of did one of those, hey, 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 I don't want any trouble, man, and walked away. But he had literally tried to grab my phone off my belt. And I had the discipline that day not to just pull out my gun and start shooting. And I think most people that have gone through the class, most law-abiding citizens that go through a class, would not just start firing indiscriminately when they felt a threat that wasn't really a deadly threat. So it's insulting to those of us who are law-abiding citizens that somehow having concealed carry licenses will increase crime.
The evidence is quite clear in every single jurisdiction that's passed concealed carry. There has been a drop in violent crime. And that makes a lot of sense. All you have to do, you don't have to be an expert on firearms. You don't have to be an expert on much of anything to understand why that's true. There are, of course, crazy people in any society, and they're a different question. But most people that steal your iPhone, that mug you, that grab your wife's purse, that break into your house, that rob the local store, are doing it because that's how they make their living. Mm-hmm. And they weigh the consequences of what they're doing. If they don't think they're going to be prosecuted for carrying a gun, and in Chicago they're very unlikely to be prosecuted for that, and if they don't think that their intended victim is armed, then there's very little to stop them from doing what they want to do. But if there's a concealed carry law and they don't know whether their next victim is going to be armed or not, that sort of makes them think a little differently than they do when they're facing a city filled with unarmed victims. So you get into these cities that don't allow citizens to be armed, that don't allow guns in the home in many cases, that don't allow concealed carry. And what you've really got for the enterprising, potentially violent criminal and drug dealer is a hunting preserve, because he knows or she knows that everybody they go after is going to be essentially defenseless.
We had a small bank. I'm talking to you from the Brian Cald Station area in the shadows of the George Herbert Walker Bush Library. And I can tell you that we had a small town bank not far from Brian Cald Station that had a big sign up, no concealed carry weapons allowed. They were robbed 3 times within a short period of time. So they took down the sign and they haven't been robbed since.
That's my point exactly, in a microcosmic way. You know, in Colorado, where the Aurora shootings took place, under the state law, if you're a public facility and you want to make it a gun-free zone, you have to provide magnetometers and such so that those who give up their guns going into your facility know that the bad guys haven't got guns either. What happened at that theater was they didn't have it. This was a private property. They didn't have any of those requirements. They just put up a sign, and the only people that gave up their guns were the good guys.
That's what always happens. I can tell you one more quick story. We had a gentleman recently in our town that was being served with an eviction notice. He decided to shoot the officer that was delivering the eviction notice and then decided he was going to start taking shots at people all around the neighborhood. One of the neighbors saw what was happening, grabbed his .380, came outside and fired at the individual who had shot the officer until the criminal ran back in his home and barred the door. And then the police came and eventually they shot the individual and he died. But the bottom line is the local police said that undoubtedly that citizen being able to carry an arm, who was actually willing to get involved and do something, saved the lives of many, many people. Now, it was reported that way locally, but as I watched the national news, it was just a shooter fires at people very near the Texas A&M campus. You know, there was no mention of a civilian carrying a firearm that was able to save many people's lives. So anytime something good happens with a firearm, a citizen being armed, exercising their Second Amendment right, you're not going to hear that part of the story on the national news, I guarantee you.
Well, a number of studies have estimated that as many as 2 million crimes, rapes, and the like are stopped each year because of private citizen with a firearm. That doesn't mean they always use it. Sometimes the mere fact that they have it stops the crime that they draw on the person that's about to do whatever it is they're going to do. But as many as 2 million instances in which crimes are prevented because of the private ownership of firearms. But you never see that on CBS. You don't see it in the mainstream media. If someone is killed someplace with a gun by a criminal or by someone, that's in the news. But not when the story tells you that the society is being protected because of the Second Amendment rights being exercised by private citizens.
Mr. Keene, it has been an honor having you here today. Before we let you go, I'd like to give you a chance to do your own little ad for the NRA. Tell my listeners what the benefits are of joining the NRA, and then tell them how they can join the NRA.
Well, you can go to our website, which is NRA.org. We've got 4 million members. According to the Gallup poll, 30 million Americans claim they're members. We rely on our membership to carry the message politically to those who need to vote to support firearms rights. We lobby in the Congress and the state legislatures, not just for your Second Amendment rights, but on questions involving hunting, gun ranges, and all the like, because unless you have a chance, unless you have the opportunity to actually exercise your Second Amendment rights by taking to the field to hunt, by going to gun ranges and the like, it becomes relatively meaningless. We provide safety training. We have thousands of trained coaches and trainers who will provide training for concealed carry permits, provide training to people that want to get involved in competitive shooting and the like. And we consider the Second Amendment community to be a family. We have one of the things we do, and one of the things I enjoy as president of the NRA, is we have over 1,000 dinners every year around the country. We call them Friends of the NRA dinners, and they raise money for our foundation, 90-some percent of which goes to youth shooting activities, to 4-H clubs, to buy uniforms for high school shooting teams, to provide transportation to competitive tournaments and the like for young shooters. And one of the most enjoyable things that I do as president is to visit some of those dinners and to meet people, because the Second Amendment community, the shooting community, is a great family. And I think that anybody that's involved and interested in the shooting sports, anybody who's interested in firearms, anybody who's interested in the outdoors ought to consider, at the very least, joining the NRA, but more importantly, getting involved, because you meet people that you're really going to like. You're going to make lifetime friends, and you're going to have a wonderful time.
Very good. I assume that all the registration stuff is online at NRA.
It's all right there. That's right. That's exactly right. Now, we're a little busy, all of us. Everybody who saw Barack Obama attack the Second Amendment in that debate, everybody who understands exactly what he's got in mind, are very busy right now trying to drag our neighbors, our friends, and everybody that we run into the polls to vote for the Second Amendment on November 6th. That is, to vote against him, vote for Mitt Romney and for Paul Ryan. I'm originally a Wisconsin boy, and I grew up about 15 miles from Paul. And I can say this, you know, I was thinking about it the other day, and not only are these two candidates committed to our Second Amendment rights, but Paul Ryan is probably, you know, an outdoorsman nominated for either the presidency or the vice presidency since Theodore Roosevelt. So this is an opportunity to vote to protect the Second Amendment and to vote to support and build up the shooting sports.
And what a great opportunity it is. Once again, Mr. Keene, Mr. David Keene, thank you for being here today. We're going to put up a link to the NRA website on our website. So you can either go directly to NRA.org, or if you happen to be visiting TeaPartyPowerHour.com, we'll have a link there for you as well so you can get signed up. Mr. Keene, once again, thank you for being here. It was an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar.